I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, as part of our ongoing commitment to American Graduate and to discussions about education in general, we're going to talk about charter schools in Indianapolis. We'll talk about what charter schools are and how they perform. My guests will be Brandon Brown, Indianapolis Office of Education Innovation, Janet McNeil, Heron High School Head of School, and Robert Enlow, President and CEO of the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about charter schools and school choice here on No Limits today. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Brandon Brown, who is with the Indianapolis Office of Education Innovation, Janet McNeil, who is Heron High School's head of school and returning for, I think, his second visit here on No Limits, Robert Enlow, who is the president and CEO of the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you all here. Well, we probably ought to start here with a question of definition. What is a charter school? I'll start. Brandon, everybody's looking in your direction, so we'll take that as the cue.
Man, they all look at me. You know, charter schools are public schools. The main distinction is that charter schools have more autonomy. So our schools have the autonomy to choose their own curriculum, to choose the length of their school year, to choose their school day length, and to, you know, really provide innovative options to students. So they're free schools. They're, you know, completely open enrollment schools. But charter schools, you know, have the autonomy to make decisions that they think are right for their kids.
And how many of them are there here in Indianapolis?
We authorize 34 schools across the city, and then a couple other charter school authorizers, I think, authorize 9 additional schools. So probably about 44 or 45 schools in the city.
Okay. Well, Robert, make the argument for a charter school here real quickly.
Well, I think the argument for a charter school is the parent has the ability, like myself, right? I'm a parent of the Heron High School, and I'm looking for a quality academic environment with a great school culture and a great school leader. And I have the option now to choose that school, even if it's outside where I'm assigned to go to school. Our traditional schools, typically you have to go where you're assigned unless you can afford to go elsewhere. And the great thing about charter schools is you now have a free access to a public education at a school that you think is best for your child.
Why did you choose Heron?
I chose Heron for two very simple reasons. One, the academic quality and rigor. When I went in there, the leader, Janet McNeil, I asked her, what do they expect from kids? And she said, I expect her kid to go to college. And that was a huge issue for me. And second, the school culture. I love the way it's set up, the way the kids interact, the way they encourage creativity.
Okay. Janet, tell me, you know, in terms of Heron, how you function differently than, say, a traditional public high school would.
We are now in our ninth year. I think probably the biggest difference for me, or maybe the game changer for how we do academics, is that we do have the opportunity to say who we are. We are a liberal arts classical high school. We don't have to have the full cafeteria menu of courses. As a matter of fact, we have very few electives. Most of our electives are in the arts, but we require all of our students to take all 4 years of the solids, and that would be math, science, English, social studies, and for us, Latin.
Okay. We are talking about charter schools here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Jenna, I'm going to stick with you for a second. Where, other than Robert's child, where do you find your students?
The majority of our students come to us from Center Township. But that having been said, one of the caveats in the charter school law is that any student living in Indiana can come to any charter school if they can get there. And so we have students spread out all over the greater Indianapolis area.
How far away? I mean, where do the farthest come from?
Some come from north of Zionsville, south of Columbus, Brownsburg, and pretty far east as well.
Why do they, you know, what, when you talk with them, I presume you ask them why they want to come. What is the primary reason?
Primarily for what Robert just described. We have a rigorous yet supported academic culture. We ask the most of our students academically, and yet we support that. We have things called office hours. We have all kinds of scheduling help that comes with the rigor we ask students to engage in. We also have a culture that is hard to define unless you walk through the doors. It is a culture of high expectations. It is a culture of safety. And it's a culture where the kids really know that we care about them. And families also feel that their students are known and they are loved.
What do you mean when you say about a culture of safety? What do you mean by that?
We have a no tolerance for a lot of things. But we have a no tolerance for fighting. We haven't had a fight in, I don't know, 5 years, 6 years. Students tend to want to be at Heron High School. And so they know the limits. They know what they can and can't do. Another thing that I am particularly proud of is it seems that in some schools, at least in my experience in some schools, it is hard for a student to do school. Mm-hmm. It's hard for them to know that Mrs. McNeil's got a set of rules, Mr. Brown's got a set of rules, Mr. Inlow's got yet another set of rules. What we did on the onset when we created Heron High School is we developed universal behavior policies. And so in every classroom, those policies are there, and students know how to behave and know what the expectations are. The only exceptions are when there needs to be more rules, and that would be in our science lab classes and certainly in our PE classes.
Robert, charter schools have evolved from something that different from what they were originally conceived to be, which was the charters were supposed to be sort of these pioneers that would test out innovative approaches that then would be applied to many, many other schools. Now it is like Heron has a very specific identity, and it has become the choice within a public school system for that identity rather than taking the lessons learned there and seeing if you can apply them across the board. What produced that change, and is it a good thing?
So I think it's a very good thing. I think what we're seeing in the charter sector is the ability to create dynamic, different quality environments that don't look the same as our traditional schools, right? So for so long, we've had a very simple, what I would argue, one-size-fits-all approach that has a kid in front of the classroom teacher for so long. And I think what's happened, instead of creating a sort of universal change through one type of charter school, we have all these different types of charter schools, like Heron, like Tinley, like Carpe Diem, which is a blended learning. You have all of these different types, and that's only good because the more options that kids have for quality schools, the better. You know, our argument would be that our goal is to care less about school type and care more about school quality, regardless whether that school is a traditional public school, a charter school, or now a publicly funded private school through a choice program. I think the goal here is to create a whole host of different options so that one size fits all doesn't work for families and parents parents can have a unique option. Maybe their child is better at arts. Maybe one's better at science. Maybe one's better at math. And so you have school types that can develop around that. And that's, I think the charter school movement has morphed in some ways into that ability to provide unique services for kids' needs.
We are talking about charter schools here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Joe, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I go back to about 1983 when I first saw the commission report, Nation at Risk, mm-hmm. and that was kind of the background for the genesis of public reform of our schools. And that became so twisted, it's become in a lot of ways, to a lot of us, it's been an attack on public education. And so often we see now kind of a two-tier system of the have and the have-nots, with money being diverted from public schools. I'm just kind of surprised why this discussion today has three. It's almost like a commercial for charter schools. I think it would have been better served with a little broader panel discussing this issue.
Well, we have had, and we found, I'll take part of that, but these discussions, we've had Glenda Retz and other advocates for traditional public education on the program, and given the volatility of the discussion, sometimes getting these folks all in the same room gets a little difficult. Robert here will tell you that the last time we had a debate on that subject, I actually had to go school marmish on the participants and inform them that we were going to talk to each other in a civil fashion. So I appreciate your call and your question, and we are going to continue the discussion. This will not be the only viewpoint heard. Janet, thank you very much, Joe.
Joe, I really do appreciate this, and I, too, go back that far, maybe even farther. But the thing that when I get up in the morning, when my staff gets up in the morning, I really don't give a lot of thought to the fact that I'm going to a charter school. I don't think our parents do that either when they bring their students or put the students on the bus. I think what they think about is I'm going to send my child to a quality high school, a school where my child will be known, where my child will experience the academic preparedness that's necessary for the world to come. But I agree. I think the conversation is too filled with rancor and I think good ideas should be shared across the board.
Well, let me ask this, and I'll throw this one to Brandon. In terms of evaluating what charters come online, sure. and whether they stay online,
sure.
what should the criteria be? Because that Joe's got a point. I mean, at least initially the argument was for charters that they should improve performance. But at least some of the more recent studies I have seen, and admittedly these are not focused on Indiana or Indianapolis, but nationally, show that that charters, only about 29% of the charter schools out there outperform public schools. Yep. So does that justify, to some degree, the investment of resources in
yeah.
them?
Yeah, so if you look nationally, charter school performance nationally is extremely mixed. And what you have to do is drill down state by state and then really drill down to the charter school authorizing quality. So when we look at the mayor's office process, less than 20% of applicants who choose to submit an application to us will actually be awarded a charter. That's really rigorous on the front end. Then what we do is we meet with our schools monthly to ensure that the academic performance, the operational performance, the financial performance is consistently meeting standard. We work with schools on an ongoing basis. We also give schools a 7-year contract. And if you consistently fail to meet standards, we close you down. So schools get more autonomy, but we also give them a lot more accountability.
Have you closed a school down, though?
We have. So in the 12 years that the mayor has been an authorizer, we've non-renewed or closed 10 schools. Mayor Ballard has non-renewed or closed 8 schools. So when we think about the Indianapolis-specific landscape, charter school performance here is exceptional. When you look nationally, the Indianapolis market is probably one of, if not the highest performing charter sector. And I think you know, my role in this is to make sure that as an authorizer, we're holding schools accountable on the back end, but more importantly, on the front end, we're effectively vetting applicants to ensure that only quality applicants actually receive charters from us.
What are the criteria for shutting a school down, for refusing to renew?
Yep, so we use what's called the Mayor's Performance Framework. Janet knows this very well. So we look at 27 performance indicators. What I will say is that Heron High School was up for charter renewal 2 years ago and still is the only school in our portfolio to meet all 27 standards at charter renewal. So we look at, you know, a whole bunch of academic indicators. We look at whether or not your kids are growing over time. We look at, you know, whether or not you have racial achievement gaps in your performance. We look at your general operational health, your financial health. So what this does is we get a comprehensive general picture of how well your school is doing, and then we engage in those conversations. And then the mayor has made it clear, schools that consistently do not meet standards and are not serving kids well will not continue to operate.
We are talking about charter schools and school choice on No Limits today. My guests are Brandon Brown, who's with the Indianapolis Office of Education Innovation, Janet McNeil, who is with Heron High School, and Robert Enlow, who's with Freedom Foundation for Educational Choice. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about charter schools and school choice here on No Limits. My guests are Brandon Brown, who is with the Indianapolis Office of Education Innovation, Janet McNeil, who is Heron High School Head of School, and Robert Enlow, who is the president and CEO of the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. He's also a parent of a student at Heron High School. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Hey, I've got a couple comments and then a question. Number one, I taught in Indianapolis for a number of years, and what I notice and what I think all teachers that work there notice is that we've got a societal issue where parents are either unequipped or don't care enough to send their children to school ready to learn, or even whether or not their children go to school. And I think not just the parents, but, you know, the community in general is failing some of these children. And when we divert resources from those public schools, the children who need the help the most, the ones that are left behind because the parents haven't made that choice to send them to a charter or a private school, are being left with even fewer resources than they had prior to meet some of those needs. And, you know, I'll also mention that school choice has always existed. It's a matter of whether or not you could afford or chose to afford to pay for it. Public education is public education because it benefits the entire community. Those tax dollars come out of our paychecks, not to teach our children specifically, because an educated populace benefits everyone. And one of your panelists said she does not get up in the morning and think about it being a charter school. And I'm sure that the Heron School is a fantastic school. I have no doubt about that. But what I would like to know is, when she gets up, does she ever think about the children that are left behind? And what do your panelists choose to do with those kids?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mike. Well, Janet, I think you've been asked a question.
Yes, Mike, I do. And I think about it a lot. And I think about how we can help those families. One thing I tell my staff and faculty is that when our students enter our door, we really don't have there's really no use in talking to about what's happening in their home or what is not happening in their home. We take students as they come to us. By law, we have to, and personally, we want to. And so we really do take kids as they arrive, whether they can read at the college level or whether they are reading at the fourth grade level. What we do at Heron High School is the only advertising we do for our enrollment period is we go to the churches, we go to the neighborhood organizations, we go to any kind of news media that might actively have at-risk parents in their population, and we tell our story. We tell our story about being successful with students of all backgrounds. And that is what we can do. I'd like to do more, but you ask if I worry about it. I certainly do worry about that.
What is the selection process? If a parent wants to send his or her child, I'm assuming it isn't just come one, come all, that you have a limited number of seats in the classroom and all of that. How do you choose which kids get to go there?
We don't choose. We take kids as they come to us until we hit our enrollment capacity.
So it's first come, first serve.
It's first come, first serve.
Robert, yeah.
And with the private school side of it, it's first come, first serve until they reach capacity, and then they have to do a lottery. So even in the publicly funded private school choice side, there is an element of ensuring that all the children have an option. I would say to the caller, I appreciate the comments, and we certainly need parents more involved in their kids' education. I will tell you that in the privately funded choice program side, 75% of the parents who are receiving a scholarship are on free and reduced price lunch program. Mm-hmm. Over half of them are families who are of color. So we're looking at a situation where private schools are now opening their doors, high-quality schools are opening their doors to children who would never have had access to those. And the last point I would make is we need to improve the entire system, and that's what I wake up every day trying to do. And I think that the charters, the choice, and the efforts to drive through House Bill 1321 is the way to begin driving all this. We need to do everything we can to improve the whole system. Yeah.
Gotten an email question. It says, how are charter schools being monitored to be sure that a religious agenda is not being taught? Yeah. And I'll throw that one to you, Brandon.
Yeah, so that's part of my job. We do ongoing site visits to our school. So like I said earlier, we're in our schools monthly. We have a series of pretty rigorous assurances that we consistently ask of our schools. Really do a whole host of things, and we've never had an issue with that. We have had a couple charter schools lease out religious facilities, and what we do on that end is we don't let school start until we do a rigorous walk through the facility, make sure that there's nothing in there that could be construed as religious. And I think to the point earlier, so Marist-sponsored charter schools serve close to 16,000 students, 90% of whom live in poverty, 60% of whom, are African American. We mirror the kids in IPS. So when I hear sometimes that we have multi-tiered system for the haves and the have-nots, that's objectively false. And I think it's important that we are clear about Marist-sponsored charter schools. Those 16,000 students mirror the kids in many of our traditional public schools. And what we're seeing is really good results pretty much across the board. So my comment would be, we're providing a great education to a lot of those students that are living in very challenging circumstances. We have to continue to expand that, work with school districts, but we can't stop. We have to be urgent because where you live in your zip code should not determine the quality of education that you receive.
Well, and I guess I want to follow up. When you say you're seeing really good results, What is the definition? Because as we said, nationally, that hasn't necessarily been the picture. Just slightly more than a quarter of the charter schools. Yeah. Seem to outperform public schools there, and obviously there are many that do not perform as well as the public schools on average. What is the definition, and who are you comparing them to ultimately?
Yeah, so there's a whole host of measures. I think probably the most rigorous, there was a 2012 study out of Stanford that was very scientific that matched up the kids in charter schools with their peers who were not in charter schools. What it found is that kids in Marist-sponsored charter schools received 3 additional months of learning in math and over 2 additional months of learning in English year over year relative to their peers. So what that says is that when you're in a Marist-sponsored charter school for 3 years, you're going to gain a full academic year on your peers who did not choose that school. So the effects that has on long-term closing the achievement gaps are terrific. We also look at the performance of Marist-sponsored charter schools versus IPS schools. And Marist-sponsored charter schools consistently outperform them by about 10 to 15% on the ISTEP. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the A to F results, we see similar trends.
We are talking about charter schools and school choice here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Mary, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thank you. So, my questions relate to advertising and marketing, and I have no concern about Heron High School in this respect. What I just heard Janet describe is a wonderful and very good marketing and appropriate marketing program. My concern lies with some of the other schools. In particular, I receive mailings at my home in Indianapolis for a multi-location charter school authorized by the mayor's office, where all three schools are presented as A schools, when in fact one is an F and one has no grade. I hear other things, including an Indianapolis Monthly article last year that talked about a per-head bounty of $110 per student being paid to people to recruit students into the Phelan School. I see things on Facebook pages for charter schools where parents are offered free uniforms if they sign up very, very early in the recruiting season. I hear and see a lot of things that concern me, and my guess is that they would concern you too. I guess my question would be, number one, are the schools required to submit their advertising materials to the mayor's office in advance? If they are not, are they submitted after the fact and reviewed and discussed with them? And then the third question would be, excuse me, but because the concern with advertising is that you don't want recruiters' interests to be at odds with trying to find the best fit for the student, as opposed to just putting a body in the school. And I know Heron does not just put bodies in school. The model where we see that kind of review is in for-profit higher education, because of the concern about that conflict there as well. And I guess I would say, have you looked at those rules on the state and federal level to see if something like that might be helpful for our charters as well?
Thanks very much for the call, Mary, and we'll try to get an answer
for
several questions, I guess, there. It's a large subject. Well, Brandon, I'm going to start with you. I mean, in terms of this, and then I'm going to throw it to Robert as well, because if we are in some ways redoing the model of how we deliver education, that is going to create new ethical challenges by definition. It seems to me a lot of what Mary was raising there, in addition to questions of law and policy, were ethical questions. What's right? Yeah. So, Brandon, is there anything? Do you monitor or police the marketing and advertising to the degree? I mean, some of that Mary was describing sounded almost predatory.
Yeah. So we monitor generally. What I would say is that we really value our school's autonomy. So we're never going to require a school to submit all their marketing materials to our office. But when we hear something from a parent or when we hear a complaint, we'll look into it. And the complaint that was just raised, I'm actually well aware of, and we've actually had a conversation with that network of schools. The marketing was pretty ambiguous, and I could see how it would seem that all three schools were an A school when actually one school was. So that's an instance where we actually received a phone call. We followed up with the school, and hopefully that school is no longer using that material. But the broader point here is that—
But do you have enforcement authority on that, or is your enforcement, you wait for 7 years and then not renew?
We have very broad authority as a charter school authorizer. So when we make a recommendation or when we say something, that really does mean that it's going to happen. The broader point, though, is that for a long time, we had school districts that had a monopoly on students, and those school districts didn't have to compete for students, and those school districts didn't really have to change their educational model because they were always going to have a stream of students. What we have now is that we have a, you know, extremely innovative menu of schools of all different types that are, you know, really trying to recruit students to fit students with the model that's going to work for them. What we've seen is that we see a lot more magnet schools now in school districts. That, I would say, is directly in response to school choice. So we are actually seeing some of the general concepts that we see for schools of choice now bleeding into school districts as well.
And Robert, I'm going to throw the ethical piece of this. I mean, it is something that probably wasn't necessarily anticipated as part of this, but, you know, when you introduce competition into a system, by definition, you do it. you create winners and losers, and obviously none of these schools want to be losers.
Correct. I mean, I think the challenges that are being discussed right now, what I like what Brandon said, and what I think happens also in the non-public sector, you have a mayor's authority quickly to respond to it. You have a non-public schools board who could quickly respond to it. You have less bureaucracy to be able to get it done quickly, right? These challenges will exist, and they exist in the current system regardless. I think one of the questions that we need to think about, though, is the incentives, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the incentives, one of the caller brought up the for-profit industry. A lot of that problem stemmed from the fact that government funding was being offered to these for-profit schools for enrollment, mm-hmm. not for graduation or completion. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about how we think of incentives, that's one of the things we need to think about in Indiana about schooling in terms of how we fund kids. Everyone talks about getting a smaller piece of the pie, and that's because they're talking about either a school district, a school, or a system. We really need to think about putting the incentives on funding kids in a student-centered, fair, and equitable way, regardless of the school they attend, ensuring that it's high quality. The other thing I would say is thank God we have the mayor's office and groups like that to be able to handle and monitor that kind of issue with marketing quickly, and that's responsive and sort of as an intermediary for parents.
We are talking about charter schools here on No Limits and school choice in general. This is part of our ongoing campaign to promote graduation and improve graduation rates in Indianapolis, in Indiana, and across the nation. It's part of a national campaign called American Graduate and part specifically of WFYI's campaign to focus on education and educational issues in general. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Christine, and if you'd like to reach out to us by Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Christine says she's curious about how Heron High in Indianapolis compensates for the lower amount of public funding it receives.
Thank you, Christine, for that question. I was at a meeting the other day and talking about the school, and someone said, you know, you run such a good school. What keeps you up at night? And this very issue keeps me up at night. We run at about a $1,500 per pupil deficit each year. And every year is a challenge. I come from a background where I'm not used to spending a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so we have a very frugal budget and we manage what we have. However, when I look at sustainability, it's something that really frightens me. We have arguably the best faculty in the city. And I know I'm prejudiced, but I'll just be prejudiced for this one time. I would really like to be able to keep every one of them. And I worry about that. I worry about that a lot. And when I think about what we are able to do in these short 9 years, and the quality that we've been able to establish, I really think that it would be so helpful for people to come visit the school, see the progress, and really get behind some funding initiatives that would be very helpful. Right now, we are dependent upon philanthropic funds, foundations, and personal donors. Takes a lot of my time, takes a lot of staff time, and I really think that those kind of issues, financial issues, are something that we as a community should grapple with.
When you talk about how you run a $1,500 deficit, how much do you spend per pupil?
We spend $8,042 to be exact.
$8,000. So about $6,500 then comes in state funding.
That's right.
And how does that stack up with, say, your average public school per student, Brandon?
Yep. So roughly for every $10 that an IPS school gets, a charter school like Heron High School will get about $7.
Okay. So in that case, what is the average funding per student for an IPS student then?
Yep. So there's a whole bunch of general funding streams, but the state tuition support for IPS is about $7,400 per student. And then the property tax revenue that IPS would get is, about $1,500 per student. So a school like Heron High School is not going to get any of the property tax revenue. So if I'm a homeowner in Marion County who sends my student to Heron High School, my property tax revenue will still go to the school district.
So I think, John, if you don't mind me interrupting, sure. I think this is a really great point to make here. So let's take a look at a child who's in poverty. And
I'll tell you what, Robert, how about if we pick that up on the other side of the break? We are talking about charter schools and school choice here on No Limits. My guests are Brandon Brown, who's with the Indianapolis Office of Education Innovation, Janet McNeil, who's with Heron High School here in Indianapolis, and Robert Enlow, a parent at Heron. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about charter schools in Indianapolis and the issue of school choice in general. My guests are Brandon Brown, who is with the Indianapolis Office of Education Innovation, Janet McNeil, who is Heron High School's head of school, and Robert Enlow, who is the president and CEO of the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice and a Heron parent. Just before we went to the break, Robert, you were trying to make a point.
Yeah, I was trying to make a point about how we fund our kids in the state. And I think this is a big issue that we as taxpayers and as parents and as concerned citizens should be caring about. Let's take a look at a child in poverty who's in fifth grade. Brandon said in IPS they get $10 for a charter school. They get $7 for that same child. For a non-public school who's receiving a public scholarship for that child, they get $4. So why is that kid who's poor and who needs services and who wants to go to a school that works best for them worth $10 in one setting, $7 in another, and $4 in another? We really need to think through what a child needs, regardless of what school they're in, and making sure that money goes to them. A place like Heron, for example, has gotten more students over time, and because of the changes in the funding formula, is getting $90,000 less revenue every year. So this same thing is happening in traditional schools, too. This is unfair for all of our schools, and that's why I think we need to get to a fair, equitable, student-centered funding formula.
Well, some of that, I mean, to be fair, we have had two sort of competing imperatives when we talk about education for at least the past 30 years. One is we really, really want to increase standards, but two, we really, really want to contain costs at all costs. And, you know, at some level, the gap between those two imperatives creates an unworkable situation, Robert.
So that's a great point, and I want to make sure I leave this to Janet and Brandon. And I'm not meaning to plug the Friedman Foundation, but today we just released a study showing about...
Well, we assumed you didn't come on.
You know, so sorry about that.
Wanted to talk with me.
So we looked into the voucher programs that were established from 1990 to 2010 and have found that they have saved their states and school districts $1.7 billion during that time. What the tragedy is we don't know where that $1.7 billion went. Right? We know that those schools, those states have spent less on those children to educate them in a setting of choice. But we don't know where that money, did it go back to the school districts? Did it go back to parents in the form of tax credits? Did it go to parks? We just don't know. There's a huge transparency problem in how we fund schools. And I think the cost imperative is better met when you create more schools of choice because you're providing an incentive to make sure parents have more involvement.
Janet.
In my world, I think the simplest way to understand this is in charter schools, we have one pot of money, and that's just the general fund. We don't have a capital fund. We don't have a technology fund. We certainly don't have a transportation fund. In my budget, I spend over $50,000 a year on Indigo passes because many of my students live in places where they can catch the bus. They have learned to negotiate all the routes, and they can get to school on time and get back home on time. So, but that's $50,000 out of my general fund, whereas another school would have a pot of money just for transportation. And so it's very hard to make it all meet. I think the one thing that charter schools have done is that we have been able to show success without excessive money. Mm-hmm. We don't spend a lot. We brag about our graduation rate. We are so proud of our graduation rate. We're projected this year at a little bit above 97% as a graduation rate, which is phenomenal. It's phenomenal across the country. It is phenomenal in the city. doesn't happen by accident, and it takes a lot of resources to make that happen.
Ren.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So, you know, research consistently shows that throwing more money at schools is not the answer. But what I would say is that we need an equitable system. So it's not fair that one student that chooses to go to Heron High School and a neighboring student that chooses not to go to Heron, those kids should be funded at the same levels, right? So it's not necessarily about throwing more macro money at the issue, mm-hmm. but we need to talk about how are we funding kids in a much more equitable manner.
But let me play devil's advocate to a degree on that. Part of the reason, that we assume with a traditional school, traditional public school, is because it is tied to a place that it's going to be there in perpetuity. I'm not sure as an investor, forget about the whole idea of taxpayer and all of that. As an investor, I want to throw something at something I'm not sure is still going to be there 7 years from now because you might close it down if it's not performing. Janet.
I think the assurity that the investor might have is to look at quality and what quality really means. Are students academically showing growth every year?
Mm-hmm.
What's the letter grade of the school, for lack of a better calibrator? I think one of the frustrating things from my desk is that we'll get some email from the federal government or the state government, and would you like to apply for this particular grant? And I'll get to the fine point print, and it says you have to be a D or F school to even apply.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a lot of research out there that suggests giving money to failing schools works.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just the contrary. It doesn't work. What really happens is when schools start from new. So it's very frustrating to think, you're almost getting punished for being a quality school.
Yeah, but on the other side of that argument, that whole, at least here in Indiana, that whole issue of school grades has come under fire, too.
I'm not saying it's the best by far calibrator. I'm just saying for lack of another indicator.
Yeah, Robert, I mean, in this context, Indiana actually became kind of ground zero for that debate nationally because of the former superintendent of public instruction here making an alteration of a school grade. And I'm not going to get into what his critics say the reason was and what he says the reason is, but the fact everyone agrees that he altered the grade or wanted it altered.
I think one of we shouldn't get into that because I think the AG cleared
yeah,
on that.
We'll have
a whole other stroke.
Yeah.
But I think one of the neat things that's happened as a result of the controversy created by the grading system is it's getting us thinking about what does it mean to be a quality school? Mm-hmm. Is it just test scores? Clearly it's not, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are a tremendous number of high-quality traditional public schools out there and a tremendous number of high-quality charter schools and private schools. So what is it that makes a school a good school? And I think as we start having that conversation and then we start funding kids to go to those schools, that's what we should be focused on. And you asked, John, the question, let me ask you one back. What is the alternative to you not funding charter schools? To continue funding schools that you know aren't going to work, right? So is what I would say to you is shouldn't we be funding the quality, not just simply the location,
mm-hmm.
right? And we could still have a vibrant common school system, and we should have that
based on
funding quality.
And I hear in posing the question, there are no decisions in life that are cost-free.
That's right.
What makes it a decision.
Right.
And one of the downsides to the approach that you say is that there's a lack of certainty going forward. Which probably, no offense, as someone who's done a fair amount of fundraising, inhibits your ability as a fundraiser, too, Janet, is the fact that a school can be shut down. A charter school is in another world between public school and private schools. Private schools can promise a certain kind of permanence, so can public schools. But the charters, as long as there is this, you have to be renewed periodically, there's always going to be an element of doubt.
We find that less and less an inhibitor for fundraising. I think the reputation that the school has established gives our funders a lot of comfort.
We are talking about charter schools here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Sandy, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a daughter who's a senior now at Heron, and someone was just talking about what makes a quality education. I think one of the things that makes Heron a school of real quality is the social environment that the teachers and Janet have created. My daughter was at one of the very high-end private schools here, and she was practically run out because the kids were so mean. And when she got to Heron, she was told, there are no cliques at Heron. And she's been there for 5 years, and there are no cliques at Heron. The kids move back and forth between one another. They're incredibly accepting of one another. And I think that that is something that helps make a school a quality school.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment, Sandy. Well, Janet, do you agree that that is an important piece of it, that the social framework of the school, that's not necessarily something that can be measured?
It is hard to measure. I wish I could. I do. I think that, and we know students are not going to learn from us until they trust us, until they feel safe. Those are the things that you have to address first before you try to teach students. And that is one thing that we take very seriously. We also have a document, and it's on our website, mm-hmm. About our core values. Every decision we make, every hire we make, every discipline decision we make is looked at through the lens of our core values. Mm-hmm. And I think there is probably that in itself is probably the biggest reason for the culture we have and the culture we're determined to continue to have.
We are talking about charter schools here on No Limits. Carl, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Certainly.
My quick question is that we have so many educational institutions throughout the world. I mean, we have China, we've got Great Britain. We've got lots of examples out there that work well. Is there a reason why we're going through this trial and error as opposed to cherry-picking from existing methods that would more or less serve us better?
Janet, thanks very much for the call and the question, Carl.
Excellent question. I think the one thing that makes Heron High School successful is that we are an organic school. We don't have a franchise. We are just who we are. We were founded by a neighborhood and one woman, Joanna Taft, and we are committed to our neighborhood. We're committed to our city, and our values and mission embodies that. I think what works for Finland would not necessarily work at 16th in Pennsylvania. I was just reading a professional magazine before I came, and talked about a Japanese method that is that's called in between the desks. You teach in between the desks, and yet we'll pull from that. Mm-hmm. I think with the new state standards, that the whole inquiry notion of a teacher monitoring the room, going around asking probing questions is really, really excellent. What we try to do at Heron High School is take the ideas that have been proven and we test them out where we are. But to say that another country's educational method would suit us, I think that's the one size fits all. And I think we all as parents know that that is not really what works for children.
Well, I guess, and Robert, I'll throw this to you since you're sort of one of the advocates for a different approach to educating. Isn't that sort of the question that we started this program with, the evolution of charters rather than as being pilots that then would be expanded to the entire system? As I heard it, you were saying charters and other forms of choice now are about trying to find school options that are specific to the places and cultures that they're supposed to serve.
Yeah, I think Brandon should answer this from the city's perspective as well, because I think I would just say simply, we don't want a Samsung phone to become the new Apple. We want Samsung, Apple, Nokia. We want a whole diverse set of quality type of options. And of course, I'm not comparing the phones to schools. I understand that. But I think the point is we need a whole set of options. And one set of charter schools should not become the one size fits all for the traditional schools.
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about in our office about we need a quality school in every single neighborhood because the future of our city depends on it. And until we have a great school that is really objectively quality, we have to continue looking at schools like Heron and saying, what are they doing? What are the core functions that Heron does well that are shared across all great schools? And then how do we replicate that? So I have an 8-month-old son who's really handsome, and I'll show you pictures later. But I
doesn't work so well in radio.
Right.
It's not a visual medium.
So you know, I'm the charter schools director for, you know, the entire city, right? But even I have a problem navigating where my son's going to go to school. My son's neighborhood high school will be a school that was 2 years ago chosen to be taken over by the state of Indiana for low performance over 7 years. My son is going to go to a good school because I have the social capital to figure out that system. What I lose sleep about is we have low-income families in this city who are working like crazy to raise their kids and to give their kids all the opportunities that they deserve. And through no fault of their own, they lack access to quality options that all four of us have. We're going to have those. We're going to be fine. My son's going to be fine. We need to give those same options to every single family in this city. And until we can say that we're doing that, we are morally letting down our families who need us the most.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Len who says, or she's got a question for Janet. What kind of accountability do you have? Presumably that's not personal. It's more in the school.
I have a lot of accountability, both personally and professionally. Probably the easiest way for me to answer it without getting into the mayor's performance framework is that I have worked in a tradition. I've only had been in three schools my entire career. I was in a traditional public school. I was in a private religious-based school, and now at Heron High School. I have more accountability at Heron High School than I've ever had anyplace else. And I know some school choice people do not always agree with me, but the one thing that I will never argue is accountability. Because as a parent, now as a grandparent, I really want the school that my family attends to be held accountable in meaningful ways. So we're accountable to the state, of course, and we are also accountable to the mayor's office. And they hold our feet to the fire when it comes to everything from our classroom handbook to our fiscal responsibility.
And in addition to that, they're accountable to the state. They're accountable to the mayor's office. They're accountable to their board. But what's neat about a place like Heron is they're also accountable to the people that matter, the parents and students.
How do you exercise that accountability, Robert, as a parent?
He does it on a regular basis.
Regular basis, I make visits and ask questions about how things are working when I'm coming home.
Okay. I think probably that's going to be the last word for right now, in part because we've got calls completely filled up. I've got more emails. We're going to continue this conversation here on No Limits. We will have a further conversation about charter schools. I really want to thank our listeners for calling in with good questions, good comments, and really moving this discussion along. I'd also like to thank my guests, Brandon Brown, Janet McNeil, and Robert Enloe. It's been a delight talking with you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It has been a pleasure. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.